It is well decided, and we agree, that students do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse door. However, it is equally well decided that those constitutional rights will be administered in a way that is sensitive to the school environment.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the High School SCOTUS podcast. Today, we have a very special episode for you with a wonderful, renowned guest. But before I get too far ahead of myself, my name is Lee Spenner.
And I'm Hannah Saroth.
And this is the High School SCOTUS podcast, where we talk about how the words of the Constitution and the decisions of the Supreme Court affect students behind the schoolhouse gate with the help of legal experts, advocates, and law professors.
And today, plaintiffs, because today we're bringing you a conversation with the one and only Mary Beth Tinker. At the age of just 13, Mary Beth and her siblings wore black armbands to school to demand a truce in the Vietnam War and honor those who lost their lives.
But the school said they couldn't. When Mary Beth and her siblings were suspended for wearing armbands, the ACLU took up their case and appealed it all the way to the Supreme Court, arguing that the students possessed a right to free speech even when they were at school. And they won. In the famous Tinker versus Des Moines, the court declared that students possess First Amendment rights inside the schoolhouse gate and may speak freely as long as they do not cause a substantial disruption to the school or impinge on the rights of other students.
But before we get too caught up in the legal minutia of the case, let's move to our conversation with Mary Beth.
Okay, we are so lucky to be joined today by the amazing Mary Beth Tinker. Mary Beth was one of the plaintiffs in Tinker versus Des Moines, which established that students have a constitutional right to free speech inside the schoolhouse gate. Mary Beth, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's so good to be with you both and to talk to students about my favorite subject, students and your rights. So I'm so glad that your podcast is wonderful. You can learn so much from that. So yeah, learning your rights, but also you both are using your rights. And I know you're encouraging others to do that as well.
Thank you, Mary Beth. We're so excited to have you on. You're a very, very special guest. So we like to ask everyone about what they were like as a teenager. And so we were curious if you could tell us about yourself as a teenager.
Well, it depends on what part of my teenage years you would be talking about, because it changed so much when I was about 13, when we wore the armbands to school. I was just kind of going along in my ordinary life, but it was mighty times, like now, a time when a lot was happening. And so like 1963 was the Birmingham Children's Crusade, when 2,000 Black students in Birmingham, Alabama, protested and rallied for racial justice. And they were attacked, and we saw the students on the news, thanks to the Free Press. And soon after that, that fall, September 15th, 1963, I was 11 then, the students were attacked by the white supremacists and their church was bombed and four little girls were murdered. Cynthia, Addie Mae, Carol, and Denise. So that had a big effect on all of us who saw them and heard about this. And so that year, there was a call by James Baldwin to wear black armbands to mourn for the little girls. And so that's what we did in Des Moines. That's the first time we heard about black armbands. But so there were lots of things to be sad about, like now. And I felt sad about those things that were happening, those little girls being killed just for speaking up for justice. And so then when things kept going on and a lot happened the next year, that was Mississippi Freedom Summer, when students came from all over the country to Mississippi to help register black voters, and three of them were murdered. So by the time I turned 13, it seemed like the world was a troubled world. And it was kind of like, I know a lot of students feel now, and just, you know, trying to figure out what to do about it and all those feelings. So then the Vietnam War was building up and building up. And there was so much of an overlap with the events of the years of 1964, 1965. By 1965, then a U.S. Navy ship claimed that it was attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin off the coast of Vietnam, the USS Maddox. And it turns out it was not attacked, but it didn't stop the U.S. Congress from then voting almost unanimously to start sending thousands more troops to Vietnam. So by Christmas of 1965, when I was 13, that was the beginning of my teenage years, and it was kind of based on some of these other things that were going on. But that's when we decided to wear black armbands again, this time to mourn for the dead in Vietnam and to say that there should be a truce in the war. And then after that, after we got suspended and everything, and I turned 14 and 15 when I was 15, well, the worst thing was the war kept going on, of course. And then lots of things happened with racial justice at the same time. When X was killed, the Selma March, and so many things were happening. First, we lost our case after we were suspended for wearing black armbands. I think I was about 14 when we lost the first time at the district court. And then I was 15 when I flew to St. Louis for the first time in my life and for the appeals court, where we lost again. So, of course, we had this feeling like anything we say or do, because we're kids, of course, we're going to lose all the time. No big important judge is going to say, oh, yeah, the principals were wrong and the school board was wrong and the teacher was wrong. Oh, but the kids were right. We just didn't think that was going to happen. At least I didn't. So it's kind of that feeling that I know a lot of students have today of seeing all these intense things going on. And you just kind of wonder, like, what are the adults doing? And when you try to speak up about it, you don't know exactly what to do or how to do it or if it will make any difference or not. And then, of course, my personal life was rolling along, and it's kind of strange. You know, I had like my first boyfriend in ninth grade, and then he dumped me, and that was like rejection. And, you know, all that stuff was going on at the same time.
It's good to hear that you were kind of able to still be a normal teenager.
Well, I don't know how normal it was. But then as I got older, in my older teenage years, then I became gay, and I don't know when I exactly became gay, but when I was a teenager, when I was a junior in high school, I had a relationship with a girl for the first time, right around this time that we went to the Supreme Court, our family. So all that was really, really intense, because that was like 1968. And it was one of the worst years for the Vietnam War. And all kinds of things were going on. Martin Luther King was killed in April. And then I had just moved to a brand new city, St. Louis, where I knew no one. And then I got to make a few friends, and then I had this relationship. The girl, which was really, you know, different. We didn't do things like that usually in Des Moines, Iowa much, but in St. Louis, then my life just took a complete change. And then it was also time to go to the Supreme Court. So emotions were high. Let's just put it like that.
Do you think you understood how unique the time period you were growing up in was, with the Cold War, the Civil Rights Movement, these burgeoning movements by children and students?
No, because first of all, we kind of had the feeling too, and maybe my parents can help with this too, to get the sort of historical view too, that these things have always been, there's always been things going on. It's not like the first time anybody spoke up for racial justice or the first time there was a big war. My dad, I remember him taking me to the graveyard in New York where some of his friends had been buried who had been in World War II. And so it just seemed like this is sort of the way the world is. No, I did not know that the 1960s were going to be a unique time as far as a lot of, you know, these kinds of things, a lot of activism.
Yeah, it sounds like your dad was, and your parents in general, were involved in a lot of your advocacy and you learning that it's important to speak up for civil rights and encouraging you to do that. But were there any other people that you looked up to as a child or teenager, especially in terms of advocacy mentors?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, my parents, they definitely were examples for us kids. My dad didn't think that we should wear the black armbands at first, but he said, you know, the principles of fate are cruel, and he was kind of conservative in some ways. And he's like, there's a rule and it's not so easy for these principles and everything. But you see, kids are so persuasive. And so we said, but wait, Dad, you always said that we should speak up for our beliefs. And we had so many examples of how he had done that. And my mom, too, they even went to Mississippi for Mississippi Freedom Summer in 1964, the year before, when they heard that the three young men, James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerger, had been murdered by white supremacists in Mississippi that summer. There was a call that went out to clergy all over the country to come to Mississippi that summer. And they were called there by people like Fannie Lou Hamer and this group called SNCC, which is the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. They're so amazing, SNCC. So anyway, they decided to call clergy all over the country to come to Mississippi. So my parents had gone there. So they came back right before I started seventh grade and told us kids what was happening. Now, some people think today that students shouldn't learn these truths, this true history. And these things are too sad and too upsetting, and especially white kids won't be able to take it, you know. But my parents believe that we should know the true history. So, yeah, my parents were very good. And it's really a family story. My brother John also wore a black armband, and even my sister Bonnie, she was like a first year in college. And then my little sister Hope, she was in fifth grade. Paul was in second grade, and they said, you know, we want peace. So they wore black armbands to school too. And we went to their elementary schools 50 years later. The principals at both schools held a big celebration with the fifth graders at both schools, and it was really amazing. So yeah, second graders and fifth graders really care about peace too. I think kids do want peace. But regardless, so there's my family. So they're very supportive. Now, other people that were examples to me were people, well, like the Birmingham children and people who spoke up, and some people that we knew in Des Moines who also, you know, spoke up for what was right. And a lot of it had to do with racial justice. So much of the rights of students in schools was the rulings and the actions were built on the actions of Black students and some of their allies too. And really Latino students too, a lot going back in history. There were some cases too of students wanting equal education. And so, but especially Black students. So that was all very inspiring too, because we saw what they had risked and what they had the courage to do, to stand up to the Ku Klux Klan, to the white supremacists, and risk their lives even. So that was all inspiring also.
You said that your whole family, all the kids in your family, wore black armbands to school, but just wearing black armbands was unlikely to bring about any tangible change in the course of the war. Why did it feel important to you to speak out, even if you knew that it might not change anything?
Well, you're so right about it. That's the number one obstacle that I think people are up against when it comes to wanting to do some kind of activism. You have this sense of futility. Like, it's not going to matter. What I do isn't really going to matter. But I had examples of the people that do it. You have to build on what others do and add your little bit to it. And they sort of had gotten that message. And that it's a way of life. It's not always thinking that, oh, we're going to stop the war. Although in some weird way, we kind of did think that it might contribute. And I heard later from people like Daniel Ellsberg, we talked about it. He exposed the Pentagon Papers. What a hero he is, Daniel Ellsberg. But he said, yeah, and he thought all these things added together to help stop the war, but it didn't stop until 10 years later. And a lot of what really stopped U.S. involvement in the war, besides the Viet Cong being victorious, besides that, was the U.S. soldiers. They started turning against the war, and they would come back from Vietnam and tell people what had happened. And, you know, they threw their medals across the fence at the White House. And that kind of went viral, you know, those kinds of actions. On almost every army base or military base of any kind, there was a newspaper usually against the war and radio shows and all kinds of stuff that the active military and the veterans were. I mean, there's a group called Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And they're still going. They were done at the Poor People's Campaign last week. There was a huge rally and parade in Washington, D.C. last weekend. And they were there saying that money should not be spent for war all the time. It should go to communities and schools and children and families and housing, things like that. But anyway, yeah, the soldiers and the military were so important in finally stopping the war. But when you feel like it's not going to matter, or, you know, your little bit doesn't matter, you just have to remember that it all adds up together and we're building something here. And it's always a time to speak up and step up. And especially it is now, with so much at stake and so much going on and the rights of youth and the conditions of youth for so many youth being very problematic. And really, we have to take some activism to improve these things.
I completely agree. But jumping back to something you said earlier, you mentioned that your father was a little bit nervous about you wearing the black armbands because the principal had made a rule.
Yeah.
When you heard that the school had passed a rule prohibiting black armbands, were you a little bit nervous? Did you harbor any doubts or fears about wearing them?
Well, yes, I was kind of a nervous person anyway. That was kind of who I was anyway. So I was sort of nervous a lot of the time. Life kind of made me nervous, I think, in some ways, in various ways. But there were 50 kids that were going to be wearing the black armbands that had signed up. It was planned at Roosevelt High School. And the idea came up as people traveled back from Washington, D.C. to Iowa that November after the first big rally against the war was in November of that year. And my brother John went, and our friend Chris Eckhart went, and our mother and Chris's mother, a bunch of people went. My sister Bonnie. So on the way back, they started talking about what we could do in Iowa about the war. And there was a whole group called Iowans for Peace. And so that's when the black armband idea came up, was when they were coming back. But so it was really kind of, the idea was sort of taken up at Roosevelt High School with some students. There were students in the, really it was the Unitarian Youth Group and some kids at Roosevelt High School, Bruce Clark, Ross Peterson, Chris Singer, and others. And they planned it, and they had 50 kids signed up that were going to wear the black armbands. But then the principals heard about it through this student newspaper. A student wrote an article, I think Ross, about what was planned, and that's how the principals heard about it. So then they had a meeting, and they made this rule against black armbands, which came out in the Des Moines Register about 2 days before we were going to wear the black armbands. So then it dropped way down to, I think, about 10 kids ended up wearing the black armbands, and 5 got suspended. But yes, I was nervous. I didn't know, but I mean, see, I had these examples of these brave people who do things. And there's also an issue of sort of civil disobedience, which I didn't really know about at the time, but you have to decide if there's a rule or a law that you feel is, you know, really wrong and you are willing to break it. It's got to be something peaceful. Can't go out and shoot somebody because you think some law is wrong or this rule is wrong, or hurt somebody. But if you want to take a peaceful protest, you know, it's called civil disobedience, as it turns out, and you're willing to take the consequences. And I knew I could be suspended, but I was willing to take the consequences to speak up about it, because expression in and of itself is also very important. As it turns out, it's good for you and it's good for the society. And I'm a nurse now and have worked a lot with teenagers, mostly as a nurse. And that's when I found out that it's actually good for you. It's good for your health, even. It's good for your physical health, your emotional health, your social, your mental health, all of it. To speak up and express how you feel and try to have an impact on the policies that affect your life. Just for the sake of doing that and living that way, turns out it's good. But at the time, I was very nervous, and I went to school, and I wasn't sure what would happen. As I said, my dad hadn't been too excited about the idea. And when I was sent to the office by my math teacher, Mr. Moberly, that morning, it was December 16, 1965. I went down to the office, and the vice principal, Mr. Willardson, he said, "Now, Mary Beth, that armband is against the rules, you know, look, so take off the armband." So I looked around and I took off the black armband. So yes, I was scared. And I thought, well, that's the end of that. You know, that's going to go pretty good. And then I got suspended anyway. So that was the kind of ironic part about it. And I think from that lesson, I did learn something that I like to tell students as I speak around the country, which is that actually, as it turns out, you don't need all that much courage to speak up about something. You can just have a little bit. And you'd be amazed what you can do with that little bit of courage. And that's about how much I had when I got to the principal's office. It just ran out. But you see what happened anyway. We didn't stop the war, no, but we did establish in the law important precedent that students have the right to speak up about issues that affect your life and to have an impact over those issues.
Let's jump forward to 4 years later, 1969, when that decision did come out. Where were you and what was your immediate reaction? Put us in your mind when that decision came out.
Well, I told you I was up in St. Louis by then at this new high school, which I had started in November, like 3 months earlier. And by this time I had my girlfriend, Susie, and I had a few more friends by then. And I was so surprised when we won the case because, like I said, I just didn't think these big important judges were going to, rule for us kids. And we had lost twice already. We lost at the district level and the appeals level. And also something that was very important that happened when we lost at the appeals level for Iowa, over at the appeals court in Mississippi, students there had been told that they could not wear buttons to school to protest the racist murders of Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman, the three young men who were in Mississippi Freedom Summer who were murdered in 1964. They had a lawsuit, those students. They were Black students in Mississippi who wore buttons to school in 1964 to protest the murders of Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman. You can see movies about this. It's called Mississippi Burning. But those students, they took their case to court and they won at the appeals level in 1966, I think. So right before we lost at the appeals level, they won. Why? Because the judges there said that the students had not substantially disrupted school. And that later would be quoted in the Tinker ruling. And that's where that standard comes from. It's from actions by Black high school students in Mississippi in 1964 who protested for racial justice. But anyway, so then when we lost, it was appealed to the Supreme Court. We won amazingly. I was so surprised. In November, we went to court of 68, and then in February, on February 24th of 1969, the ruling was decided by 7-2. It was a very strong ruling for what education should be in democracy, that schools should not be enclaves of totalitarianism, and that students are persons. Yes, that's kind of nice. Students are persons with the rights and responsibilities of persons. And so it was a very good ruling. But so I had just been at my new school for like 3 months and I had this little friendship group. I didn't really know about the word gay that much then even. It was 1969. There was this, feeling in the culture that if you were gay, there was something wrong with you or something, and that you had to definitely keep this a big secret. So it was very weird. My mother was a psychologist. So until 1973, the American Psychological Association said that homosexuality was a mental illness. So I certainly didn't want my mother to know what was going on. That's for sure. So it was very intense. And then we won the case, by 7-2. The war was raging. It was one of the worst years for the Vietnam War. But oh, wow, suddenly we can wear a little black ribbon on our arm to say that we're sad about the war and how we feel about the war. And remember, some of these kids who had worn that little black cloth on their arm, they could be drafted at age 18, and they had been told they couldn't even wear a black armband to say how they felt about that war. But, oh, we could send you off to war, but no, you can't express how you feel about it. That's why it's a youth rights issue, for sure. This whole case is about the issue of youth rights internationally and nationally. But so it was kind of hard to be really happy when we won the case, let's just say that. at first, for sure, because the war was raging. You know, it's on the news all the time. These horrors. It's called a war of atrocity for a reason, because so many horrible things happened in Vietnam, and many civilians were being brutalized and killed, and their homes burned, and all these terrible things going on. So, yeah, it took me a while to realize that there was a victory in this, even though the war didn't stop. There was still an important precedent for youth rights in this case. And so, yeah, I got a little bit cynical for a while after we won, but eventually I did realize there's something good about the victory, too.
So kind of delving into the legal nuances of that victory and the Tinker decision, and also the rulings that would follow Tinker in decades to come. The Tinker decision held that student speech could not be prohibited unless administrators could prove that the speech caused or is likely to cause a material or substantial disruption to school activity. Is that a high standard of protection for student speech?
Well, not really, because it's very easy for a school to say that what is going to be said or expressed could substantially disrupt school or does substantially disrupt school. Now, the second part of the ruling said that also students' free speech cannot impinge on the rights of others. That's called sort of the second leg of the Tinker ruling exceptions. So number one, you cannot substantially disrupt school. And if there's a prediction of a substantial disruption, that could even be enough for the administration to censor what's going on. Like some students in California, they wore American flag shirts to school. This became a Supreme Court case called Dariano about 15, 20 years ago. And thus the administration predicted that there would be a substantial disruption with these American flag shirts. Why? Because they wore them on Cinco de Mayo to mock the Mexican kids. And so the administration blocked the shirts with the American flags, and the court upheld that, saying that they predicted a substantial disruption. My brother and I actually wrote an amicus. We signed on to an amicus brief in that case, saying that they should not censor the students, that they should instead use dialogue and talk with the students about it and work it out that way instead of just censorship. But anyway, so it's not really a high standard. It's easily met, and schools can censor speech under Tinker that is either going to cause a substantial disruption or thought to cause a substantial. Now, it's supposed to be substantial. Like there's a case in Buckeye Union, Arizona, where a student wore a Black Lives Matter shirt to school, Mariah Havard, and the administration said, oh, no, you can't wear that. It's going to cause a substantial disruption. Why? Because she had a little argument with a classmate the week before about Black Lives Matter. Well, that's not a substantial disruption. And the school board lawyers had a little talk with the principal, who changed his mind. And the student was able to wear the shirt to school. So it is supposed to be a substantial disruption, but it can be met. Things like school walkouts could theoretically be considered substantial disruption, although wise administrators have chosen not to punish students for a lot of the walkouts.
That, I think, is really the power of Tinker, is that these questions don't have to be decided by a court, but you can have a school board lawyer that says, don't do this, you should let her wear the Black Lives Matter shirt, or a principal that's just smart and says, why don't we let kids walk out? Like, how big of a deal is it going to be? It could be a lot bigger deal if we don't let them express their rights.
Exactly. You're so right. And there are a lot of administrators who are really trying to help students express themselves, and I've met many of them, and some students I was talking to a few weeks ago, their principal had worked with them. They had a walkout around gun violence, but it happens a lot, you know, that. And then the students had a question, well, if the principal helps us, is it still a protest? Is it still worth doing, you know, if the administration is going to be in on it too? And my feeling is like, sure, it still matters. Of course, you don't want them to run it and completely water it down. It should be student-led, and you should still be able to express your point. got them, you know, overtaking it, but it's still a good thing to express yourself and try to change gun violence any way you can. Of course, it doesn't just happen by a one-day walkout. And I talked to the students, you know, about how you've got to keep going on that, you know, after that too. It's not going to be solved by a one-hour walkout or whatever it is. It's kind of ongoing.
You're right. And we talk a lot about free speech in a very positive sense, you know, being an activist, speaking out on issues that you care deeply about. But as you mentioned, there was that case where the students wore American flags to school, mocking on Cinco de Mayo. And, you know, under the First Amendment, for a general person, a person that's not in school, hate speech is protected by the First Amendment. But what about at school, if the speech is racist, bigoted, homophobic, is that speech substantially harms another student, so should not be allowed, right?
It's not protected in schools. Schools have a different standard for free speech than the public. And now we're talking about public schools that are, you know, under the First Amendment, a private or independent school. Well, a lot of times private independent schools have more free speech, just because in our country, the First Amendment is kind of on a sliding scale. A lot of times, if you have a lot of upper income students or a lot of white students at your school, there's a pretty good chance you may have more free speech, even at a private school, than a public school that has a lot of low income students. So there's that. Because like take journalism, for example, only 25% of high school caps student journalism. And so at 75% of schools, there's no freedom of the press. And you can imagine which schools have journalism. It's not the poor schools that have a lot of kids of color. So there's that issue that happens too. But yeah, when it comes to free speech, it really depends. But this case covers public schools because the First Amendment says that Congress shall not, you know, censor your right to free speech, free press, the right to assemble, the right to petition, and the right to have your own religious beliefs. So it's government cannot censor you. So, oh, wait a second. What was the original question?
I was just asking about the different standard for hate speech in schools versus outside.
Oh, yeah. So there is no real definition for hate speech legally, but under Tinker, speech that is thought to impinge on the rights of others at school can be censored because of that second part of the exception in Tinker. Tinker set out two exceptions to free speech for schools, for public schools, students. Number one, you cannot substantially disrupt school and even the prediction of substantial disruption. Number two, cannot impinge on the rights of others, okay? And under that, things like Confederate flags are banned. Oh, shirts that say God is ashamed of your homosexuality have not been allowed because they're thought to impinge on the rights of others. There was a case in, I think, Idaho last week where some Wisconsin, where some students wore like AR-15s on their shirts. And they lost their case, I think, at the district level. And they just won. They didn't exactly win at the appeals level. The appeals level said the district court should take the case back and now look at it as far as whether it goes against those Tinker standards, whether wearing a big gun on your shirt either causes a substantial disruption or predicts a substantial disruption under Tinker, or number two, whether that in itself impinges on the rights of students to feel safe in school. So now they have to go back to the district court to look at it from that angle, which they hadn't really looked at it before. So yeah, it comes up that exception about hate speech and hateful speech can easily be censored under Tinker, under that second part of the Tinker ruling, second or even under the first part around substantial disruption a lot of times.
I'm really glad you talked about the distinction between independent and private schools and public schools in terms of rights, because I go to an independent school and I get, as the resident, like, student rights lawyer for the students, I get a lot of questions. Can a school do this? Saying we can't do this at the dance, that's illegal. I'm like, you signed a handbook. Like, yeah, they can do whatever they want. Like, you don't really have rights in this case. So I appreciate you mentioning that.
I mean, there still are limits for.
Oh, of course, of course.
Private schools. I mean, like, they can't be physically abusive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There is a handbook, like you said.
Yeah.
And a lot of the Tinker ruling and other rulings kind of affect independent private schools sort of indirectly, not legally as much, but I mean, a lot of students at independent schools, they don't want to go to schools that are real, you know, full of censorship.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of times your parents don't want you to go there either, that kind of school. So therefore, it has an effect indirectly.
Definitely. So in recent years, it feels like the court has only eroded the Tinker standard further rather than build on its foundation. If Tinker came before the court today, do you think they would rule in favor of you?
I think the Tinker ruling would stand because of these two exceptions. There really is quite a lot of room for administrators to still get involved with student speech. And now even social media, there's a lot of gray area as far as what administrators can do or not do as far as social media. Of course, there was the case at the Supreme Court in June, Mahanoy, which was a victory for student speech when Brandi Levy put up the Snapchat post basically cursing her cheerleading team, and she won at the Supreme Court by 8-1. That was a public school. But the thing is that still there is a lot of room for administration to get involved, even in social media or some out of school speech. In fact, sometimes schools and school staff there's something called mandated reporter, which nurses are covered by, teachers are also. If you are aware of some kind of abuse or mistreatment, let's say, of a child, you are required to report that and get involved. And so there are sort of legal issues around that. So there is still quite a bit of leeway, despite Mahanoy, where administrators could get involved still. There's kind of a gray area. The door is open, let's say, after Mahanoy for administrators to still get involved in student speech issues, even outside of school.
Yeah, I think Hannah and I both observed that Mahanoy was a very interesting case because the court refused to set a hard and fast rule, one like Tinker, for regulating off-campus speech. They didn't say that Tinker should apply. They didn't say schools have no authority to regulate off-campus speech. And they kind of said that was an undue punishment for what she did, but didn't really say what exactly would happen in future cases. What do you think? Do you think Tinker should apply off campus, or should the school just have to say we can't play any role in restricting the speech of students when there are like parents available to do that job?
Well, yeah, it depends on the parents. Parents are all different too. And some can be reasonable and unreasonable too. It just depends. I mean, I'm a nurse, a trauma nurse with children and teenagers. So sometimes the issue comes up with parents, you know, and what's going on between the parent and the children as well. But I don't think the schools should really get involved with out-of-school speech in general. There might be some exceptions, but first of all, administrators really don't want to monitor your speech 24 hours a day and watch your social media. I mean, I've talked to a lot of administrators, teachers, et cetera, also. They don't really want to have to take on that responsibility a lot of times, first of all. But also, it's such an invasion of your privacy to think that schools would be doing that. So, of course, you know, it's sort of a balancing act, too, because there's a danger for violence and mistreatment of students, as we know so well in our culture. Our culture is one that has too much violence, and we know we've got a gun culture that's kind of out of control, as we can see. And so there is an issue, you know, with trying to keep students safe. My feeling is that students should have some say about how all that happens in your schools, and the policies that are developed to make that happen should be ones that students also developed and had input into, you know, what kind of policies. Like, oh, I was talking to a principal who had been involved. There was a problem with social media in the school because the students were posting things that disappeared very quickly. And so it was a problem. And my feeling was that the students should be able to get together with the faculty and work out what should happen. Students don't want to have all kinds of harassment on social media either. And so a lot of times I think administrators should turn to the students for the solutions to these problems as well. You have good ideas. You're so creative.
So connected to you talking to students, you started the Tinker Tour in 2013, where you brought civic lessons to students and teachers all around the country. And you talked about your story and the stories of other students who refused to let anyone restrict their free expression. But was there a certain impetus for the launch of that tour?
Yes, the impetus was the times that we live in, and that it's a really important time for young people who are so affected by the issues that are going on in our world, in our country, in our cities and states. I mean, whether it's gun violence, pollution, the climate emergency that we're in, racial justice, LGBTQ issues, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the list goes on and on. School library censorship, tuition for college, all of these issues are so important. And it's so important for you all to be able to have a say about what's decided about these things. And so that was kind of the impetus for it. And I was working as a nurse. As I said, most of my career was with children and teenagers. I started as a trauma nurse, and I worked as a trauma nurse a lot. When I started the Tinker Tour, I was still working on an adolescent trauma unit at a hospital. But I saw, as a nurse working with youth up close and for real, how it's a society that disrespects young people and your needs, and that you don't have too often what you need to thrive. School budgets being cut back too often, kids drinking polluted water, breathing polluted air, worrying about whether their family's going to have a home to live in or be evicted, whether they'll be able to pay for the blah, blah, blah. You know, it just goes on and on. And I learned as a public health person too, which I got into public health too. I was a family nurse practitioner, but I had 2 degrees, one in nursing and one in public health. And so I learned over the years that youth are the most likely to live in poverty in our society, teenagers and children, and all of the consequences of that, all kinds of trauma and not having needs met and things like that, a society that doesn't put kids first. So that's when I decided, you know, over the years, like, wow, kids really need to speak up for themselves. And maybe they could use the First Amendment, because that's a way that a lot of groups who have been disrespected, that's a way a lot of groups have spoken up for their own interests. What would help you? What would help you thrive? What kind of society would be good for you? What policies would help you? Like, there's a big debate right now. There's a child tax credit that was put into action during the pandemic, and families with children got like $300 a month for each child. That ran out, and it brought like 40% of children who were living in poverty out of poverty. And now people want to continue that because it's a way that kids can rise up out of poverty. And a lot of senators and representatives are saying, no, that's not a priority. They're sending billions of dollars, you know, for war, and all kinds of other things. So anyway, these issues impact you and young people. And I just decided that it's very powerful when young people speak up about your own issues, and that maybe there's something in my story that you might be able to relate to and that would kind of encourage you. So that's why I started traveling around, and I quit my job at the hospital. I went with a lawyer for the Student Press Law Center. That's a wonderful group that has to do with student journalists' rights. And of course, the ACLU, so supportive. They've always been wonderful over the years. All the cases that came after ours that had to do with student free speech, all the cases at the Supreme Court, which is Bethel versus Frazier, Hazelwood, and the Matthew and the Bong Hits for Jesus case, Morris v. Frederick, and then Matt Hanoi also. All those cases are ACLU cases. including ours. So we also talked a lot about the ACLU on our Tinker Tour. I went with Mike Houston, a lawyer with the Student Press Law Center, and we traveled all over the country that first year. We went to over 100 schools, middle schools, high schools, colleges, conferences. Speaking about students' rights, we traveled in a big pink van that was decorated for the First Amendment. It was hot pink with balloons painted on it, and so it was really great. And we stopped at all these parking lots of high schools and stayed there. It was crazy. So I just decided that it's the best thing that you can do for your health, students, is to speak up and advocate for yourselves. And that's good for you. And so that's when I started just speaking with students all the time. And that's what I do now.
While it does seem more important than ever for students to speak up, and because there are so many issues that affect students, it feels like there are also more barriers than ever to student speech. And the Supreme Court has set out that it can't cause a substantial disruption, it can't be lewd or vulgar, if it's in the school newspaper, it could even have to get the principal's approval. Why do you encourage students to fight on regardless of the barriers and traps in their way?
Yes, well, there are so many victories also. One of the great victories has been a campaign called New Voices. Now, 15 states have passed legislation, and this is a student-led campaign. It's associated with the Student Press Law Center to have states pass legislation saying that in our state, we are going to protect students' free speech rights, especially in student journalism. And it counteracts the effects of the Hazelwood case, which hurt student free speech, the Hazelwood versus Kuhlmeier case. And Kathy Kuhlmeier has worked very hard to pass some of these laws. She was the student editor in that case. She still lives in Missouri. But so there have been a lot of victories, and many states have passed laws. Check it out, the New Voices campaign. There's 15 states now where students are covered by legislation to go farther than the Tinker ruling and protect student free speech rights. So, and there are all kinds of victories. I could tell you about a student, Destiny. She was in Chicago, and they tried to put an incinerator right next to her high school, and the students at the school fought that, and they stopped it. That was really great. I was at the March for Our Lives rally last week, and thousands of people came and spoke about gun violence, and that's an ongoing issue, which I feel very strongly about. But students in Pennsylvania have a whole campaign because their teacher was fired for helping a trans kid at the school. There's just so many examples of young people speaking up about so many things. So that really is heartening.
Well, Mary Beth, thank you so much for leaving us with a positive note. I think it can be often easy to get cynical and get pessimistic about the state of things for kids and in the world at large, but good to remember the positive things. And one of those positive things is that we were so lucky that you could join us today. And it just brings light to our day to hear you speak. And we hope that other people will hear the same.
You both are such a light in the dark. This is really great. And just having you, help students learn about these issues and encourage students to use their rights and know about all of these rights. And it's just so wonderful to see how you're using your rights to make a difference. And how do you feel about doing that? Has it been something, what role has all this played in your lives? Has it been a good thing, or in what way?
Well, I think for me, for one, it's just been eye-opening, I think, to see this whole new perspective on our rights as students and how we exist in schools, and that there are rules, but there's also a lot more freedom than we might have known to act. And I think it also has been a bit saddening to see kind of how oblivious some students are to the rights that exist and to the freedoms that they possess and don't possess in schools. And I think I want as many of my friends and students and people that I don't even know to understand what happens and outside of their school, but how that affects what they can do in school.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really important, and it helps students kind of, I think, deal with these times. It can be so stressful. We have to kind of stick together and look to each other and help each other. How about you, Hannah? How's all this wonderful podcast that's been developed by you two? It's great. How's that affected you?
I think it's just been the biggest learning opportunity of my life, just getting to talk to so many people I really admire who care about things that I'm really passionate about and have involved that in their professional working lives. And then being able to take that to people at my school and people in my state and people I'm connected with on social media and be like, I got to have this amazing conversation with someone I really look up to, and I think you should listen to it. That was really special. And so I think just being able to continue to do that, I'm really grateful for all the learning that I can do.
It's so great. It's so positive. And learning, growing, connecting with each other. So we want to emphasize all of these positive things these days. And I'm so glad that you two are doing that. And it's really been great to be with you, and let me know if I can ever do anything to, you know, help other projects that you're involved with. And also students who are listening, or anyone, if you want to contact me, write to me at tinkertour@gmail.com, and I'll be glad to write you back. So thanks again, Alisa and Hannah. So good to be with you, and keep up your good work.
Thank you so much.
What a joy to speak with Mary Beth Tinker. Her story is an inspiration to both me and Elise, and to students around the country. We'll see you soon with an episode about the two Religious Liberty and Establishment Clause cases at the court this term. Carson v. Macon and Kennedy v. Bremerton School District from my home state of Washington.
But for now, leave us a rating, drop us a review, and for more coverage of the Supreme Court by teenagers, check out the High School SCOTUS website at highschoolscotus.com. On the blog, you can read oral argument previews, opinion analysis, and interviews with eminent legal scholars. Everything you need to stay in touch with the court, especially as the term comes to an end. That's highschoolscotus.com. We can't wait to see you next time.